The views expressed in the following program do not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.
Live from West Babylon, New York, this is Sports Talk 1240.
Good evening and hello again, everybody. Welcome to hour number one of Sports Talk 1240 on WGBB, Freeport, Long Island, New York. Bill Donahue taking you through the first hour on this Sunday night, the 12th day of June. Our engineer, Brian Graves, is across the way. We've got a great show lined up for you tonight. Up first, we'll welcome in the great Hall of Famer, the Hawk. Andre Dawson will be with us. In the second half, we'll talk to the former New York Mets pitcher, member of the 1986 World Champion Club, current SNY analyst, Ron Darling. He'll be talking about his latest book. So sit back and relax. Enjoy Sports Talk 1240 tonight on WGBB. We've got some great stuff ahead in the next few hours. As always, before we begin, I invite you to follow us on our Facebook page titled Sports Talk 1240. There you'll find sports information, show information, and more. So stop by, give us a look, and then you can give us a like. You can also follow us on Twitter at Sports Talk 1240. And all past shows can be heard on our website at www.sportstalk1240.com. My first guest, he's an eight-time All-Star, eight-time Gold Glove winner, NL Rookie of the Year in 1977, and National League MVP in 1987. He's elected to the National Baseball Hall of Fame up in Cooperstown, New York in 2010. I welcome to Sports Talk 1240 tonight the Hawk, Andre Dawson. Andre, it's great to have you with us.
Thank you very much. Good evening.
Good evening. Now, you grew up in Florida. Who were your favorite teams, your favorite players, any idols growing up in baseball?
Well, growing up, I was more so, I think, a L.A. Dodger fan.
Interesting. Okay.
That being because of some of my older relatives following that team. They were big. Koufax, Drysdale, Willie Davis, Tommy Davis fans. And, you know, it's the only thing that I heard, so it was more so the only thing that I knew. I would say the players that I followed were Aaron Mays. They were always in the limelight, in the headlines, Mantle. Usually the stars that stood out at the time, and I think, you know, as a kid, even though I wasn't really exposed to the sport that much, you'd see a little bit of it on Saturdays on the game of the week.
The game of the week, right?
Right. I quickly, you know, became a baseball fan and looked forward to the World Series, which was usually played in the daytime.
Right.
I think games starting about 1 o'clock during the day, so I can remember trying to get home from school so I can see the World Series.
Right. Now, your Montreal Expo team, Andre, Dick Williams was called in to manage that ball club. What did he bring to the team that was different than the previous management?
Well, experience, for one. He was part of some teams that had previously, you know, won in the past, and he was seasoned. He was a veteran in a sense, and I think he had a knack for letting you go out, letting you play. At that point, you know, we were still pretty much an expansion ball club, but he let the young players go out and play. He really didn't demand a lot. I think he had the people looked at him and they kind of sensed that he had issues if, you know, you struggled as pitchers. But he was tougher on pitchers, I would say, than the position players. But he did allow you to just go out and for a young team anyway to have fun, play the game, and abide by his rules.
Certainly. Definitely. Now, talk about Andre Forrest, that great outfield that Montreal fielded with Warren Cromartie, yourself, and Ellis Valentine. Give us a little insight into those guys.
Well, both Ellis and Warren were drafted a couple of years ahead of myself. I was the third to come up and to the big leagues, to actually play in the big leagues. It took me all of a year, I think, and a half, and maybe three at the most for, you know, those other two guys. But, you know, we were all within a year of age, and Ellis probably the young. I think Ellis was the youngest. Yeah, Ellis was later July. I was early July, and Warren was in October. Mm-hmm. But we were all up through the minor league system and touted at that time probably the best young outfield in the game. But, you know, we didn't approach it that way. We kind of fed off of each other. We learned a lot from each other by playing together day in and day out. And, you know, we enjoyed the opportunity to go out and get all of the praise, especially being as young as we were. And as I said, we were still pretty much a young ball club with, you know, a Gary Carter behind the plate, mm-hmm. You know, a young Rodney Scott in the infield. We just looked at it like, you know, this is going to be for a few years that we will be able to go out and play together, and, you know, hopefully we can gel and do the things, you know, that it takes to be a winner and, you know, have some success in the years to come.
Certainly. Now, you spoke a little bit about the kid, Gary Carter. We know what he meant to the New York Mets ball club when he got here. What was his impact on the Montreal ball club?
Well, he was, you know, behind the plate. He was the one that, you know, really, I think, was the more vocal leader on that ball club. When I say vocal, he was, you know, not loud in a sense. He was just the one that was more media accessible and, you know, the one that the media would go to and usually try to get the lead stories. He did, as I mentioned, handle the pitching staff. And he was, you know, charismatic in his own way. He knew that, you know, he was probably the best young catcher in the game. He often made conversation about how Johnny Bench was his idol, and he was trying to pattern his game after Johnny Bench. But, you know, he was our unsung leader, in a sense, because he, you know, was very similar in age, I think. Probably a year, maybe a year older than I was, but he was, you know, we were all right around the same age, and he was just the individual that, you know, we knew and we can count on day in and day out to go out and handle the pitcher staff and do a good job of doing that.
Do you feel, Andre, that that Expo Ball Club should have had more success than it did?
I think the problem with the club that we had, we had a lot of good talent, but playing in that ballpark in the early part of the season and getting all of those rainouts and having the doubleheaders mount later in the season probably took its toll more so than not. We always felt that we were maybe a premier free agent, a two away, mm-hmm. A veteran presence coming in as a free agent, being, you know, someone that could ease the day in and day out pressures that a young ball club would encounter and just help trying to solidify the ball club itself. We were just that one marquee free agent away. But I do feel we had a lot of success, but you know, we always fell short. The teams that usually beat us out at the end of the season, once it was Pittsburgh, another occasion it was Philadelphia, and another occasion the Los Angeles Dodgers,
right. They
all won the World Series.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, if there's any consolation, it was that, you know, despite we have a good year, or we had a good year, we lost two teams that went ahead and won the World Series.
Right. Now, speaking about the elements at Olympic Stadium, old Olympic Stadium in Montreal, you had some issues with the turf. I know you had a knee injury from college, from high school in playing football. That turf really took its toll on you, didn't it?
Well, I played on it for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it was only after I was a free agent and I went to Chicago that I really, really and closely noticed how damaging it was. After playing, you know, on grass for 4 or 5 days and then you go to turf 3 days later, you really feel the stiffness and soreness set in. I think because I had gotten so used to it on an everyday basis that, you know, I just pretty much bit the bullet and took it all in stride. But I do feel, you know, moving to the natural playing surface did extend my career. But, yes, I do think, you know, I suffered as a ball player playing on the AstroTurf. We had the worst turf, I think, in all of baseball. And the entire time that I was there, I think they only changed it once. It was coming apart at the seams.
Oh, boy.
And it was literally like playing on concrete. But, you know, it didn't really dawn on me until I was in Chicago and playing on the grass that I could really notice a substantial difference.
Now, you went to the Cubs after becoming a free agent in 1986. The Expos, Andre, really didn't make you a fair offer, I believe, and the era of collusion was upon the sport at that time.
Yeah, I was at the end of my 10th year. You know, it was time to renegotiate as a free agent, and I, for whatever reason, felt, you know, I would retire and wear that uniform all of my career. But, you know, the business aspect that came into play didn't allow that.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted me to take a cut in pay as a result of, you know, being a free agent, and I thought it was a slap in the face.
Sure.
And, you know, I felt that was just a starting point with them. And that at some point there would be negotiations, but, you know, because of collusion, they really took a stance and they didn't budge. And I can recall meeting with General Manager John McHale at the time in the off season, and he said their stance, their offer still stood, and had I made a decision, and I at that point thanked him for the previous 10 years, and I told him that the writing seemed to be on the wall and it was probably time to move on. I just felt if I'm going to have to take a cut in pay, then it's going to be somewhere where I want to go, and I know that I'll enjoy the move. And it just got to be a matter of pride and principle.
Sure.
And I just, you know, knew that because of collusion, it was going to be tough going to a ball club with a salary, with, you know, a figure in mind. We had to devise a way to get a team interested, and we knew that the only way that a team would even sit down and listen would be to let, you know, them make the offer as opposed to us making, you know, an offer to the ball club.
Mm-hmm. And you guys did just that, your agent and yourself. You spoke to Dallas Green, who I believe was a little leery at first. You gave him a blank contract, more or less, and you ended up signing with the Cubs.
Right. That's the direction we took. We met with the ball club out in Arizona, and they didn't really know what to make of the blank contract. Dallas Green thought it was some sort of a ploy, and I just said, no, it's, you know, pretty clear. It's what it is, you know. You pay me what you think I'm worth. And the first thing he said to me was, I have a young ball club that, you know, I need to pay close attention to, some kids that I need to give an opportunity to play. They were, I think, 3-4 years removed from the playoffs. Mm-hmm. And I said, I know, you have to do what you have to do, but I'm going to, you know, leave this offer here for you to decide where what direction you want to go. And the following day, I'm going to go to West Palm Beach and do the same thing with the Atlanta Braves. And he said I'll probably hear from him within 24 hours. And when I got back, I flew back to Miami. When I got back home, he did call the next day, and he was actually offering me $500,000 less than what Montreal was offering me.
Wow.
I just said, Mr. Green, thank you very much. I'll accept that offer. And he got kind of quiet. He didn't really say anything for about 10 to 15 seconds, and I said, hello, I thought I had lost the call. And he said, no, I'm still here. He said, can I call you back in about an hour? And I said, yes, I'll be here waiting to expect to hear from you. And sure enough, he called back, and he welcomed me aboard and said, I know you were just here. Take your time coming back out. But I was back out in Arizona the next day.
Sure. Why not? Now, what would have happened, Andre? We got Andre Dawson, the great Hall of Famer, with us tonight on Sports Talk 1240. If Dallas Green did not accept and you went to the Braves and maybe they'd pass too, what would you have done then?
Well, I can remember having a conversation with my wife, and I said, well, if nothing works out here, I'll probably go to Japan.
Wow.
And she said, good luck. I'll see you when you come back. She didn't want to have any part of it. So, you know, I don't know. I know I was, you know, going out on a limb, sticking my neck out. I was just hoping that, you know, it wouldn't be too embarrassing. I know Tim Raines, a good friend of mine, was in the same situation. And he was, I think, offered $100,000 and $200,000 by two other clubs. And that was the main thing. You know, that kind of went through my mind. Just, you know, it wouldn't be too embarrassing. But I knew they would make me an offer to refuse.
Mm-hmm.
But, again, at that point, it was just a matter of my pride and the principle about the whole thing.
Exactly.
If I was going to take a cut and pay, I was going to be man enough to stand up to it and just, you know, go where I wanted to play, and that was in Chicago.
And that you did in 1987. Andre takes the MVP in the National League, the first man to win the MVP for a last-place club. And to me, Andre, that shows, win or lose, you play the game the same way.
Well, yeah. You know, I didn't set any goals for the first time in my career. I just looked at it like a new beginning. And what really happened, my grandmother passed just before spring training started, and I just going to dedicate the season to her and go out and have fun. I struggled at the outset, maybe the first couple of weeks or so, before I hit a grand slam off Todd Warrell in St. Louis, and that kind of got me going. Mm-hmm. But I didn't really feel my way around. I didn't really feel my way around as a veteran ball player. I just, you know, said that, you know, this is where I'm going to be for this season, and, you know, whatever impact I can have on this ball club and the success, then, you know, I'm just going to go out there and try and leave it out all out on the field. And
right.
Once I hit that home run, things kind of got going for me. It just appeared that things were happening on a daily basis, and it turned out to be the best year of my career.
Certainly was. Now, you had some great times in Chicago. You signed as a free agent in 92 with the Boston Red Sox. You go to another hitter-friendly park. Was your feeling then, Andre, to try to get to 500 and 3,000, those magic numbers?
Well, you know, the history with the knees really started
right,
to take
right.
its toll. I was swinging the bat real well coming out of spring training. My first year in Boston, and then I did something where I probably should have slid going into third base, pass ball. We were playing in Texas, and that was a pass ball, and I tried to chop my steps. I was on second going to third and stand up instead of sliding, and I hit the corner of the bag and twisted the knee. I didn't even know I still had cartilage in my knees, but I had cartilage damage and had surgery, and at that point they decided they wanted to platoon me, let me play not on a regular basis in the outfield, but move more so toward the DH role. And it was something that was new to me. I just didn't feel like, you know, I had the rhythm coming off the bench. I thought I was sitting. And then the second year, you know, we were faced with the strike. And at that point, I just, you know, said, well, I'm not sure what's going to happen from here on out. And I had aspirations of trying to get to 3,000 hits. We talked to Cleveland about, you know, maybe coming aboard, and I thought we had a deal up until the 24th hour, and they backed out. They, I think, kind of used our end of it to get Dave Winfield to resign.
Oh, okay.
And once they agreed to a contract with Winfield, then we didn't hear from him anymore. And I just said, you know, I was going to retire and, you know, go on ahead and go home. I was a little over, you know, a couple of hundred hits from 3,000.
Right.
And the Marlins called. They wanted a fourth outfielder for their young ball club, a mentor in the clubhouse. And I really had to mull that over because I wasn't sure if that's what I wanted to do. But after a few weeks, I knew that I was going to be working out anyway, and Miami is my home.
Mm-hmm.
So I get an opportunity to sleep in my own bed, and I don't have to play every day. I accepted that offer and finished the last 2 years with the Marlins.
The rest is history, yeah. Now, 5 years after you retire from the Florida Marlins, Andre, you make your first appearance on the Hall of Fame ballot. It took 9 years on the ballot to finally get in. Were those tough years watching that election every year?
Well, it wasn't tough because, you know, I started out 45% and
right.
I kind of hoovered around the 50th percentile. And I saw players that I played with, my teammates, get in, and I just, you know, figured at that point, well, you know, did I do enough? Had I done enough? And I knew that, you know, I had better numbers, but I can honestly say I think it kind of lost a lot of the luster, you know, waiting to get that call. I just said, and I heard from different Hall of Famers that you just got to let the process play itself out. You don't try to politic to get into the Hall of Fame. You don't see anything that's going to upset the writers, you know.
Oh, no. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, they just, you know, reminded me that when it comes time, you know, for you to get to that point, only then will, you know, you get into the Hall of Fame. And I just, you know, realized that, you know, the people that were in a similar sort of situation, waiting to get in, and I weren't able to hurdle them, that it would take some time. And, you know, as it did, it took 9 years. And, you know, the end result is whatever the wait process is, you know, when it happens, you get that call, and it doesn't matter anymore how long it took.
Exactly. And you're there now. You're where you belong. Your Hall of Fame speech, the theme was love baseball and the game will love you back. You've certainly loved baseball, Andre. Tell us what a day is like working with the Marlins these days.
Well, I'm, you know, I've been with them for 16 years now. And I kind of wear a few different hats.
Mm-hmm.
I'm the special assistant to the president, but you know, I will go to spring training. I will dress out, assist the outfield instructor. And I'm at all of the home games. I don't really travel with them because I'm not a coach per se. But I'll go and do some minor league player evaluating, do a lot of public relations.
Yeah.
And I'm at home in uniform every game, and once the game starts, I'll go upstairs, kind of be available for the president, the general manager, answer a lot of what if, why, what you think questions. So, but they move me around. I keep busy enough, and I was often asked about a coaching position, but I didn't feel I really wanted to put the uniform back on full time and, you know, have to subject myself back to all of the travel again.
Right.
But I enjoy, you know, what it is that I do, and I've been with them now for 16 years.
Wonderful, Andre. Well, I tell you, it's been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you tonight. I'm glad we finally got you on. I thank you for spending part of your Sunday night with us. Please thank P.J. Loiello for helping us get together. And, Andre, I guess we'll see you in a couple of weeks up in Cooperstown.
Okay, thanks. Thanks for having me.
If you're at CVS or if you're in the hotel, we'll find you and we'll say hi.
Okay.
You take care. Andre Dawson, folks. Up next, we'll talk to the 1986 Met, Ron Darling, about his new book. So stay with us, folks.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240 on Long Island's AM 1240, WGBB.
Country Foot Care, official podiatrists of the New York Lizards, have been delivering state-of-the-art foot care with good old-fashioned caring to Long Island residents for over 30 years. Specialists in sports medicine and foot injuries, Country Foot Care can be reached at 516-741-FEET or online at countryfootcare.com.
Want to advertise your business on Sports Talk 1240? Place an ad on sportstalk1240.com and run a radio commercial during the show every Sunday night here on AM 1240 WGBB. Our rates are very affordable. We'll even produce the radio commercial for you. Just head over to sportstalk1240.com and fill out the Contact Us form and let us start promoting your business today.
Unflippable, unflappable, unleakable. The Gustbuster is the only umbrella that won't flip inside out, rip, tear, or leak. Capable of withstanding winds over 55 miles per hour. All of our umbrellas are constructed of the finest quality materials and backed by a limited lifetime guarantee. What are you waiting for? Visit Gustbuster.com and get your Gustbuster today.
Stay connected to Sports Talk 1240 by following us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Sports Talk 1240.
You're listening to Sports Talk 1240, broadcasting every Sunday night beginning at 8 p.m. right here on Long Island's AM 1240 WGBB, the station that serves your community. And now, back to the show.
All right, we're back with Sports Talk 1240 on GBB, Freeport, New York. Bill Donahue with you on this Sunday evening. A great sports weekend. The Mets continuing their road trip. The Yankees, classic Old Timers Day. Nobody does it better than the Yankees on Old Timers Day. The Belmont Stakes, and I hope you're enjoying Sports Talk 1240 tonight. Well, my next guest was a member of the 1986 World Champion New York Mets. Many of you younger folk, you'll recognize him as the analyst on SNY and Pix 11 on the Mets broadcast. His new book is entitled Game 7, 1986, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. We're honored to have with us tonight and welcome in Ron Darling to Sports Talk 1240. Ronnie, good evening.
Hey, great. Thanks for having me, Bill. I appreciate it.
No problem. Wonderful to be with you. Now, you grew up in Massachusetts, Ron. Who were your favorite teams, any favorite players, any idols growing up?
Well, if you're anyone my age, 55 years old, that grew up in Boston or Massachusetts, your favorite athlete was Bobby Orr for the Boston Bruins.
Okay.
You talk of anyone my age, we always tried to pretend to be Bobby Orr. But, you know, I was a Red Sox fan, especially the 67 team, the impossible dream year.
Uh-huh.
And my favorite player was a Long Islander, of course, Mr. Yastrzemski.
From Bridgehampton, yes. The great Yaz. Now, I had looked while doing my homework, Ron, May 21st, 1981. You faced Frank Viola. of St. John's in an NCAA postseason game. You had a no-hitter through 11 innings, and in the 12th, St. John's breaks it up and scores on a double steal to beat you 1-0. Now, that remains the longest no-hitter in NCAA history. People may not realize that, and the game is really considered to be one of the best in college baseball histories. Now, the New Yorker, Roger Angel, ran a story about that. Now, what I couldn't believe is during the game, they recognized another spectator. Smokey Joe Wood was there. Do you remember that?
Well, I don't remember that. I was busy pitching, but I know in Roger's wonderful piece, The Web of the Game, he ties not only Frank Viola and myself to Smokey Joe Wood, who, of course, won 41 games
in right.
one season. And it was, you know, Roger, I consider him the best baseball writer that ever has ever graced the planet. And it was great to be involved in that. I don't know what it says about me that the most famous game I ever pitched I lost, but that's kind of how it goes. I'm really proud. I'm really proud that it's still the longest active no-hitter to be that long. But I'm even more proud of, and I'm not even in the College Baseball Hall of Fame, which is pretty funny. But what I'm really more proud of is that I started 28 games for Yale and finished 28 games. And I don't think anyone else around the country ever did that.
28 complete games. That's pretty good, Ron. Yeah. Now, Ron Darling is selected in the first round of the 81 draft by the Texas Rangers. He comes with Walt Terrell to the Mets in a trade for Lee Mazzilli. Now, you guys were a pretty good combo before they sent Terrell to Detroit for Hojo. 85, though, you lead the league in walks. You settle down a little bit after that, though. Who do you credit with helping you honing your control, Ron?
Well, you know, I didn't start pitching until I got to college, so I really was learning on the job. I was still learning in the major leagues when I made it to the Mets in 83. But, of course, it was the great Mel Stottlemyre, one of the greatest Yankees of all time. I consider him the greatest pitching coach in Mets history. He had one of the best collection of young arms. He nurtured those arms. He really was like a second father to all of us. And after about two or three major tweaks in my delivery, you know, I went from leading the league in walks to being, you know, 40 or 50 a year, which is a real, you know, not a bad number. So, honestly, if it wasn't for Mel and his great not only wisdom but also sensitivity to a young athlete, you know, I wouldn't have had the success I did.
Yeah, I remember Mel as a kid throwing to Jake Gibbs in the old Yankee Stadium, and he was some pitcher himself.
Well, he came up when he was 20 years old and, helped the Yankees down the pennant race that year. He was a fantastic hitter. In fact, I think he had a grand slam in a game and, won 20 games. You look at the back of his baseball card, he was unbelievable.
Yeah.
And he suffered what a lot of guys in today's game don't, and that is an arm injury. Guys can recover from them now, but in those days, your career was done.
He was pretty much steady, yeah. Now, you played for some great managers, Ron. Davey Johnson, of course, one of them. We'll talk about Tony La Russa in a minute. What did Davey Johnson mean to the ball club, and do you think he should get more respect as far as Mets managers go?
Well, he's the best Mets manager they've ever had. So, you know, I don't know why anyone would not give him respect. He's the only manager that's had sustained success with any Mets team. The team was a winning team in 84 when it won 90 games, then it won 98, 108, 90, 104. I mean, you just keep going on and on. So anyone who doesn't give him any kind of platitudes is mistaken. The great thing that Davey taught me, and I think taught all of us, is that, you know, professional sports is an occupation, it's a job. And as soon as you realize that, you start to get in the mode of doing your job well. And he was the first guy that ever identified to me, anyways, that baseball is a team sport, but it's played by individuals. So Darryl Strawberry's got to play 150 games. Keith Hernandez has to play gold glove type caliber first base. Gary Carter's got to hit his 30 home runs. Ron Darling's got to make his 35 starts. So he never made it feel as though there were goals that you couldn't obtain. All you had to do is do play your game, and if everyone else around you did, it would be a wonderful ride. And I'd never heard anyone explain professional sports like that, and it made it easy.
A manager, really, in every sense of the word.
And he was just, he was one of the first guys to use a computer. His on-the-field managing within a game was impeccable. He also played hunches, which a lot of managers are forbidden by some organizations to do. He just had a great feel for the game. It was great being around. Win or lose, you knew he made a decision by the hitch of his pants. And sometimes that's fun to play for a guy like that.
Sure. Now, what's the difference between Davey, Ron, and the Hall of Famer, Tony La Russa?
Well, I think Davey was more of a like I said, you know, he was more of a riverboat gambler as opposed to Tony. To me, seemed like such a tactician. Tony, I think, had to me it seemed like he had every move down five or six moves before he had to make them. I'd never played for a manager like that. You know, I always thought that he made a move one or two times before he made them. He was six or seven ahead of any other manager I ever played with, and he taught me one thing that I've never heard from anyone in the business world, and that whenever he was angry at a player or angry at a situation, umpire, whatever, he would write it down and during the game and then give it 24 hours. And if he was still angry at that player, situation, et cetera, he would address it. But sometimes he said many times he would not even care about it the next day and was happy that he did not address it and let it go. That would probably serve a lot of CEOs well also.
Interesting. Very interesting. Yeah. Now, the new book, Ron, is called Game 7, 1986, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. One thing I'd like to address is the chapter about the jar. Now, we'll explain that to the folks. I remember...
I can explain it to them easily. The jar is about amphetamine use during the 80s, and... the reason I included, and I chose every single word in this book, so, you know, there's no saying I was misquoted. I chose every single word delicately. And the reason I wrote about amphetamine use in the 80s is because I was really getting tired of a lot of players I played with or my generation of players talking about steroids era and other eras, that the guys today don't play the game right, that we played it perfectly in our day. We just simply didn't. We played it great. We had some really amazing times, but they were also trying to get advantages at every moment, like every generation of professional athletes. So it was really my address to I'm not even opposed to amphetamine use. I think in a day-to-day game, where especially today where they have Sunday night games and then a day game the next day, which Los Angeles Dodgers recently did, I'm not even opposed to amphetamine use. I'm just opposed to players of my generation thinking that players today don't know how to play the game right, and we did. It's not true. They play great. We played great. Hard to compare.
Great point, Ron. Yeah. And you do bring out the aspect that it has been going on well before the 80s. I remember Buddy Harrelson talking about the greenies back in his day. And then you had you mentioned the juice during Hank Aaron, Willie Mays' day.
Yeah, I mean, every generation, I mean, you know, 1919 Sox, Black Sox scandal, we're trying to sell the World Series. Professional baseball comes from a strange place in the early 1900s where there was gambling on games, and there was a lot of drinking during games. There was a lot of strange stuff. So that's where its foundation has come, and it's come a long way, of course, to a game that's as clean as it can make it right now. But for us to think that all of this money, and still today this money, when we see players that are found that have done steroids, your first question is, how could you do that? That doesn't make any sense. And if you really look at it, you'd really want to say, how could you not do it when the pot of gold at the end could be a $20 million contract a year?
Exactly.
So it's always been done. The economics of the game are so high right now that I think if you're a Midland kind of player, you want a little of that pot of gold.
Definitely. Now, this book talking about the World Series in 86, Ron, was it a cathartic experience for you?
I think it was cathartic. I mean, for the folks at home, most fans, not Mets fans, but most fans of the 86 World Series think it ended on the ball between Buckner's legs. It did not.
Right.
There was a Game 7 to be played. I pitched it against Bruce Hurst. And the reason I wrote it was two reasons. One is that to let people know what Game 7 was all about from the first pitch to the last pitch. And then second really was to show that most athletes write about the greatest moments that ever happened to them. And I think that what really happens in sports is that there's two titans clashing, and everyone has been great their entire life, and every time they had to come up with an amateur great game, they always did. But professionally, it's a different ball game. And I came to two things in the book that I think are true and made it a cathartic experience, is that with the rain out, I had 48 hours to really put myself in a paralysis by analysis mode. And then second, and I think more importantly, it's a really an homage to the Boston Red Sox, who are a great team, and save for a couple of wild bounces in that game, maybe they're celebrating the 30th anniversary of a world championship. They're not. We are. And that's why it's failures for me, but of course triumphs for my teammates.
Definitely. Now, the contrast in the career high and the career low in one evening is very interesting that you make in the book. Can you sort of look back on it now and enjoy the season as a whole and be satisfied with what you did?
Yeah, you know, I've heard a lot of people say, you know, how could you be mad? The Mets won or whatever. It's not mad. It's just when something sticks in your craw for that many years, you just want to write about it. And like I said, be a cathartic experience. I'm so happy that I wrote it because now I can let it go. You know, it's an old enemy that I can shake hands with. He's gone. I can truly enjoy everything that was done in that 86 season. 108 wins is a very unusual for a team. You know, we hear teams win 95. They're the greatest team ever. They'd have to win, you know, 13 more games. Mm-hmm. That's how dominant that team was. We had the best right fielder, best catcher, best first baseman, best pitcher in all of baseball. We had a young pitching staff. And I always tell people when they ask about that 86 team, you know, what made it really special. You know, our utility man was a guy named Kevin Mitchell, who would win the
right.
National League MVP a couple of years later. So on our team, he couldn't even play. So it kind of tells you the talent.
Definitely. Now, there's one situation that I recall in that game, Ron. The veteran umpire, John Kibler, gives Boggs a 1-1 pitch. What would you say to yourself if you had to come out for a mound visit and to quell the emotions after that call?
Well, one of the, you know, when you think of sabermetrics and analytics today, you know, there's so many things that are really relevant. There's so many things that are hard to understand. But one of the most important things in baseball is the 1-1 count. It's the race to win that count. If it goes to 2-1, we know the numbers of what hitters hit. If it goes to 1-2, we know that the pitchers usually dominate. So really the goal in every game is to win that 1-1 count. Mm-hmm. And I'm not crying that I didn't win it, that Kibler didn't call the pitch I thought was a strike. It's just that sometimes when you don't win it, you got to be more mature and get through it. I wasn't, so the fault's on me. It's certainly not on the late John Kibler, who's a fantastic umpire and a great man. It was simply that I wasn't mature enough to get over not winning that 1-1 count that I thought was so paramount to my success that night. What I would say to myself is that, hey, it happens. Get a bigger backbone, and let's get through this at bat. I didn't do it, and that's probably why I wrote the book. It's a lesson in humility that all of us, professional or not professional athletes, always think we're going to get something done, and patience is a virtue, certainly.
Definitely. You're speaking to Ron Darling tonight on Sports Talk 1240. This book is full of candid insights like that from Ron that you folks would enjoy. Now, after that first inning, did you feel like telling Davey or Gary Carter that the ball felt heavy in your hand? First, talk a little bit about how the ball feels heavy.
Well, I think for folks out there that watch a lot of baseball, the ball feels heavy is probably the same as when you're going to work and you just feel tired. you know, and you just don't want to go to work that day. It's the same kind of feeling. It's that ennui that sometimes affects all of us. And for an athlete, and especially a starting pitcher, when that ball feels heavy in your hand, and you hear pitchers today talk about it, they'll say, boy, the ball's not coming out of my hand very well, or it is coming out of my hand very well. It's the same adage, just a different way of saying it. What would I have said to Davey? Absolutely nothing. There are many games that I pitched where the ball felt heavy in my hand, but I was able to get through it. I certainly thought this was going to be another case of it. It didn't work out. And again, I said, I think it's a lot of it is on me for the paralysis by analysis, but you have to give the Red Sox a lot of credit. They faced me three times in 11 days, and on the third time, they had my number, and I just wasn't able to be better than them.
Good way to look at it, Ronnie. Now, how helpful do you think your battery mate would have been to you in writing this book? I mean, if we were blessed with the kid being with us today, would you have gone to him for his feedback to see what his perceptions would be?
You know, professional athletes, you know, you're in charge of your own domain, you know, and, you know, you wouldn't go to the catcher or you wouldn't go to the first baseman. They have their own, you know, Keith's got to get his three hits. Gary's got to maybe hit a homer or do something big. His job is to catch me, to put the right numbers down. It's my job to execute.
Okay.
So when I'm not executing, it really has nothing to do with him. And I think if you notice in the book, I never one time ever questioned the call or anything he put down. It was really my lack of execution. So when you're at that level, the catcher really puts down the fingers and you execute the pitches. If he were still alive today, absolutely. I would have went to him and I would have gave him the first draft and said, what do you think of this? And I'm sure Gary would have had a lot of comments about it, and it might have changed the book in some ways. But you know, the bottom line is that in professional sports, you're in charge of your own thing, man. And you know, it's the most amazing scrum in the world because all of these kids come from their little hamlets, and they're the best player that ever came from where they came from at 6 or 7 years old, and then they get to the stage at 22, 23, 24. And there's this terrific scrum where they all clash, and who's going to make it through? It's very Darwinian. It's very based on meritocracy, and it can change from year to year. But that's why professional sports are great, and that's why the ones, you know, like the, you know, the Gretzky's and the Orr's and the LeBron James and you know, I'm missing the Peyton Mannings. That's why they're held so dear to all of us because they can not only rise above it, but stay above the fray for such a long period of time.
Definitely. Now, it is the 30th anniversary of the 86 Club. We've had the book. I don't know if you've read it, the Eric Sherman book, The Kings of Queens, about more or less like a Boys of Summer type book about the current day situation with a lot of the ball club. You write this book. Was it just time to tell this story, or did you do it in conjunction with the 30th, Ron?
Well, I think marketing-wise, I think I'd be disingenuous to not say that it made sense to do it at this time. So,
right.
You know, I thought it was a good way to get the book out. I thought it was a good way to get the book read. But like I said, I literally had this stuck in my craw 2 days after we had the parade in downtown Manhattan. So I thought it would organically go away and that this book would never be written. But it still lingered, and I always wanted to write it, and I had bits and pieces of it written from 30 years ago to today, and just really molded it 4 or 5 months ago. So it's been there for a long, long time. I'd be disingenuous if I didn't say that 30 years makes sense to release it, and or maybe even more importantly, 30 years was enough for me to own it. Now I don't
right.
have to anymore.
Yeah, maybe a lot of us should write a book, I think, Ronnie. I think that's a good idea. When are you back in the booth?
Back in the booth on Tuesday night. They have a day off, and we'll be three men in the booth. So it'll be Keith, I, and Gary. And there's nothing better than working with those two gentlemen. They're so talented and so funny. And Gary really is. I mean, you know how I feel about Keith. You know, he and I have walked the same path. But you know, Gary, to me, is the caretaker of Mets history and the caretaker of Mets baseball and the caretaker of Mets broadcasting. And that's really hard to do because the Mets now are in their 55th year. They've got a wonderful history that they're trying to build on. Even more importantly, in many of the lean years, their broadcast teams have been amongst the best, or at least the most iconic. And we're trying to do our bit to try to keep up with Lindsay, Bob, and Ralph. And we know we can't, but we're doing our best.
You certainly are. Have you seen the fashion tips with Keith?
Oh yeah, no. We're always trying to think of stuff that will be comedic, because baseball is a great game, but it's also a long game. It's a long season, and I think it's important for our fans to know that we can not only laugh at the game, but also laugh at ourselves.
You do, and even when somebody's getting shelled, or things aren't going the greatest, you can always count on you guys to come up with something to keep everybody going.
Hey, listen, we've all been there. You know, Keith's had a bad day, many less than I have. I've had bad days myself, so I know those things can happen. So it's not that we gloss over them. We definitely will be critical and say what they could have done. But at the same time, we don't need to belabor anyone, because the great thing about baseball is that there's the sun comes up the next day and you have to play again.
Definitely. And any new projects coming down the pike for you, Ron?
Yeah, it's funny you said that, is that I'm going to write a couple more books probably in the near future. And the next one is going to be on the Yale-St. John's game that you brought up earlier in the broadcast.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, I think that I certainly hate to write anything after Mr. Angel has written The Web of the Game, but it'll be a totally different perspective. I really want to try to do it like Bill Bradley's Life on the Run, something where you get a taste of not only the Yale team, but also the St. John's team, who those guys were then, who those guys are now, and not only the famous ball players, but also the ancillary players. I have players on that Yale team that are doctors and artists and make movies, and the St. John's team has the same. So hopefully I'll be able to capture that just like Bill did with his great Knicks teams.
Definitely. Well, Ron, it's great to have you with us. The book, again, is called Game 7, 1986, Failure and Triumph in the Biggest Game of My Life. Get it on Amazon and find it in the bookstore local to you, Book Review, Barnes & Noble. And, Ron, it's been a pleasure having you with us. We enjoy you on the telecast, so we'll wait to hear from you Tuesday night. I thank you for taking time out of your Sunday night to be with us.
Thank you. Anytime, Bill.
You take care. That's Ron Darling, folks. Before we leave, I'd just like to mention, again, we were talking a few weeks ago about Saul White, the Baseball Hall of Famer who came out of the Argyle Hotel in Babylon, which the Argyle is unsung in a way as the birthplace of black baseball. We have a few minutes. I just wanted to go down the list of the other Negro League stars who are in the Hall of Fame. You have the executives, Effa Manley from the Newark Eagles, who is the only woman in the National Baseball Hall of Fame. Alex Pompez from the New York Cubans. Cumberland Posey from the Homestead Grays. Of course, Saul White from the Philadelphia Giants and the New York Cuban Giants from the Argyle Hotel in Babylon. And J.J. Wilkinson from the Kansas City Monarchs. Some of the others we can talk about, of course, Cool Papa Bell, who could hit the ball and be at second base before the ball got to the outfield. And they say also he could shut off the light and be under the covers before the room got dark. Ray Brown, Willard Brown, Oscar Charleston from the Pittsburgh Crawfords, Andy Cooper, the great Martin DeHigo, who people claim is definitely one of the greatest baseball players of all time from the Cuban Stars, the immortal Josh Gibson from the Homestead Grays, Frank Grant, Pete Hill, Monty Irvin from the Newark Eagles, the great Hall of Famer with the New York Giants, Judy Johnson from the Hillstead Daisies, Buck Leonard from the Homestead Grays, Pop Lloyd, Biz Mackey, Jose Mendez from the Cuban Stars, the immortal Satchel Paige from the Kansas City Monarchs, Luis Santop, Mule Suttles, Ben Taylor, Cristobal Torrente, and Judd Wilson, the Negro Leaguers in the Baseball Hall of Fame. So if you go down to Argyle Park in Babylon on the Railroad Avenue side of the park, towards the west side, you'll see a home plate and a little monument for the New York Cuban Giants who were the staff of the Argyle Hotel at one point in Bablin Village. So just a little local history that you may not know about that you can go and check out to keep the game of baseball in your heart. Well, that'll do it for me tonight on Sports Talk 1240. I'd like to thank my guests, Andre Dawson and Ron Darling, and my engineer, Brian Graves, most of all you, for joining us. Stay tuned for hour number two with Eric Getzoff on Sports Talk 1240. I'll be back with you next Sunday, June 19th. Till then, Bill Donahue wishing you a good evening, folks.
Expressed in the previous program did not necessarily represent those of the staff, management, or owners of WGBB.